support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Who will house the refugees moving around King County and Seattle? We'll discuss that and the rest of the week's news this hour with my panelists. My panelists are South Seattle Emerald reporter and writer. Welcome back, Lauren Bray. Good to see you, too. We're going to get all the microphones turned on. Yeah, how about now, Lauren? Yeah, we're working on it. Former chair of Nikki Haley's Washington campaign, the founder of Gameron Legal Consulting. Welcome back, Saul Gameron.
Thanks for having me.
And former Washington State Democratic legislator and founder of Earth Finance, Reuven Carlisle. Welcome back, Reuven.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Lauren, I want to make sure I can hear you well.
I think I'm on
now. Oh, that's it. Beautiful. Okay, that's on us. All right, so you can watch us on YouTube, by the way, because we're streaming the show as we do. Just search KUOW Public Radio. Okay, let's get to what happened this week, what it means. And I'm going to tie some threads together to start the show, because this week Seattle went from the old defund the police call to offering cops a big raise. Oregon went from decriminalizing drug possession to recriminalizing drug possession. San Francisco has made similar moves recently as well. So I'm going to ask each of you, has the West Coast progressive movement of the last few years, was it a real progressive movement? Has it been a failure? So keep all that in mind. First, let's tell listeners more about what happened this week. City of Seattle reached a tentative contract deal with the rank-and-file police union, and we're waiting for details. But so far, media are reporting that entry-level officers will make $103,000 a year, 23% higher than the old contract, retroactive for the highest starting policing salary in the state, if ratified. Lauren, is there? Do you see any problem with
Can you hear me, Kevin?
Salary for jobs that you're having trouble filling?
Okay, awesome.
In the midst of a impending budget shortfall of about $240 million, mm-hmm. I think was the last figure, mm-hmm. last time I talked to somebody about it, I think it's a pretty big problem. If we're not able to, I guess, anticipate how we're going to invest in other things,
yep.
if there's conversations about, you know, the citywide hiring freeze, I don't understand where this money is coming from.
Hmm. Anyone else?
You know, I think in the budgeting world, we all have a sense of priorities, tension about what's a top priority, what's not.
By the way, this is Reuven, former legislator. That's so you've right. done some budgeting.
Done some budgeting, about $70 billion state budget. And of course, the city has challenges at their level as well. But ultimately, you know, the law enforcement and police costs are overwhelmingly paid by the local tax dollar. And the city, the county, the state, the federal government all intermix on all kinds of budgets. But most of the local law enforcement is the obligation of the city, as Lauren said. The challenge, though, is that we have a real issue on the table in which there's no question we need more police. And there's no question that law enforcement has really been struggling these last few years for a whole host of issues and reason. It's a market, and we've simply got to provide enough police officers. And the way to do that is to pay them appropriately, just as we support our teachers and our firefighters and other public servants who have the highest level of expectations of quality. I think we need to have that same level of expectation for police.
Well, I do want to hear from Saul. I would point out that the city is not saying, we're trying. We thought about defunding the police. We're trying to set your analogy of teachers. They're not saying, we're trying to come up with alternatives to teachers. I mean, there is still a live argument about whether we need more police in the city, although maybe that seems settled. We'll talk about that in a moment. Saul, any reaction?
Well, we're down 500 police officers. We need to hire 500 more police officers. It's a market. Of course this makes sense. I'm not sure it goes far enough, but I completely support what the mayor is doing.
Lauren, any reaction to the idea that if we're down 500, we need 500?
I just simply disagree. I don't think that it is within our best interest to hire so many police officers when Mayor Harrell's plan for recruitment and retention is making police hiring easier, faster, and more efficient. For me, as someone that has questions about police bias and a lack of training police officers to deal with crisis intervention, how is this plan to make police hiring easier, faster, and more efficient? How would that, you know, bite us on the butt in the long run? We spend hundreds of millions of dollars in lawsuits for wrongful death for police officers. It's just, it's going to create more money more money problems in the future, I feel.
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive issues. I think you can hire more police and do more training. I don't think you have to have one or not the other.
Well, Mayor Harrell's present plan is to make hiring easier, faster, and more efficient. So if we're talking about making hiring easier, faster, and more efficient, lack of training, less training is kind of assumed in that, especially when there's not already a present environment that supports bias training for police officers already. That's still something that is in question as to whether or not we need that. So I don't know. To me, as someone that, you know, has a lot of concerns about police accountability and about the role of policing presently, I think that there could be an alternative solution. And I think that we could divert some of the energy that we're spending on hiring back those 500 police officers to maybe looking at alternatives to policing. Sexual assault cases are not being investigated. It could be assumed because of the lack of police, but it also could be that it's not a priority altogether. Maybe if we looked at organizations, task force, other social services that could potentially, you know, pick up some of those responsibilities that have historically been delegated to police.
Since Lauren brought up accountability, that's a very important part of this contract. Sometimes when we talk about policing and the problems, I'm not inventing the idea that Seattle Police Department has a problem. This is a dozen years of being under a federal consent decree. The Justice Department found that Seattle officers had routinely used excessive force, showed evidence of biased policing. The city has spent $200 million trying to comply. There is a judge who decides how long federal oversight lasts, and the judge did not like the last contract because he said it didn't hold officers accountable enough for misconduct. If they got disciplined, sometimes they stayed on the job. Sometimes discipline got, you know, reversed. They got reinstated. The burden of proof was too high. Not enough oversight. The process wasn't transparent. So the you don't have to believe that. Some, as I hear from listeners, you have an anti-police bias. You're claiming that you're stereotyping police officers and saying that they're all bad. And you know, maybe someone's free to make that claim, but that's not the claim. I'm not talking about whether all police are, you know, dark-hearted or what, you know, what they have malintent. The issue is that the Justice Department, as it's identified, and as we've seen. We've all seen videos. We've seen individual incidents. Doesn't mean that every cop is all the same. We're not saying that. But the issue is that, according to this federal judge, the contracts keep being not holding police accountable enough. So separate from salary, we're going to be, as we find out more about this contract, finding out whether the accountability measures will satisfy this judge enough to get Seattle out from under this consent decree. Is that fair?
Yeah, there's no question that the accountability issue goes to the core of a lot of concern, and it is raised in every venue because of this consent decree. I still think, though, that that there's a yes and conversation. We can have the highest levels of accountability and oversight and community engagement, and we need to recognize that I don't think it's appropriate to think that it's just anecdotal that small businesses in Greenwood or a neighborhood in Seattle or somewhere else are really facing property crime increases and issues. I was at my dentist just last week, and her office was broken into. The safe was broken. It was stolen from a dental office. And the coffee shop next door, the bakery next door, all of those had break-ins in the last couple of months in a very organized way. These are tiny, small businesses, and I just don't think we can lose sight that the community needs a sense of connection and safety, and those are real and authentic needs citywide and as well as region-wide. So yes to full-scale conversation about what accountability looks like with all of the evidence-based global best practices from around the world, as well as a level of police presence that is really goes to the integrity of recognizing the impact today.
Okay, for the record, two out of the three panelists on the show in support of more policing, saying that the lack of police is a real and tangible and pressing problem for the city. It's not universally held. It's okay for things not to be universally held. We're having a conversation. Okay, so that's one thing to hold in our minds, that defunding the police never happened. The budget was reduced a little bit by moving traffic enforcement around to a different department, you know, moving 911 dispatch to a different department. But and yet there has been a backlash, not just in Seattle, but in the country, and especially on the West Coast, a backlash against the idea of it's a whole mix of things. It's crime, it's police shortages, it's fentanyl, it's capitalism. It's all right. It's a whole bunch of stuff going on, and in that context comes the state of Oregon. This week, the governor signed a measure to recriminalize drug possession. This is Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Conrad Wilson, who told us this week that the governor partly rolled back a ballot measure that voters had approved in Oregon in 2020 that decriminalized possession of small amounts of cocaine, fentanyl, and meth. And this new law makes drug possession a misdemeanor crime, and it expands funding for substance abuse treatment.
It also lets drug users who come in contact with police to deflect from the justice system into treatment programs. But the law also allows for a county-by-county approach, meaning treatment programs could look different depending on where you are and not exist at all in other parts of the state. People caught with drugs who don't or can't access treatment could face up to 180 days in custody.
Reuven Carlisle, you are a relatively progressive state legislator, but you consistently voted against drug possession decriminalization in Washington, right?
Pretty much. There was a very important state Supreme Court ruling, the Blake ruling, that in effect decriminalized at the drop of a hat the full scale of drug possession and activity. And I think that we didn't have the back end systems and support and programs and policies to be able to build anything to sort of deal with that. So I voted against continuing with the immediate implementation of that, and thought we should take a delay and really try to step back and ask ourselves more holistically what ought to happen. I also have to say that the experience in Oregon is not trivial. It's very powerful. They did a lot of learning down there, a lot of learning relative to San Francisco as well. You know, ultimately, we live in a time where what are the societal boundaries? And a lot of legislation came in the state, and of course, we see it at the city level as well, about what are the choices that people need to make. And if it's completely legal for someone to sit on a park bench across the street from a school and inject heroin, and there's no one to call, there's nothing to do, that is outside the bounds of societal norms. At the same time, the war on drugs is a categorical, total, moral, legal, criminal failure as well. So this is another example where the extremes just don't work. I don't think that we can expect that there's sort of self-regulation with the world of fentanyl that we live in today and the damage. So I think we need a sense that of high quality support services, but social boundaries of community expectations of boundaries are that there needs to be some degree of oversight and accountability relative to criminal activity regarding drugs.
I think the biggest issue with understanding, or I guess misunderstanding, decriminalization is that it's not a solution to the addiction crisis. It literally just says that being an addict or having an addiction.
I have her maxed out.
Crime, right? It's not. It's an illness, right? So I think when people talk about decriminalization not working, they talk about it as it's a solution to addiction or to the addiction crisis, when really it's just to keep people from being punished for having an illness. So I partially agree with what you said about being against it and not having the social safety nets to, I guess, really do something with it. But at the same time, I'm an abolitionist, so I'm always going to advocate for decriminalization. And I think that it definitely did good in the sense that people didn't have to be incarcerated for their addiction or for their illness, but it definitely did not put forth any sort of social safety nets, any sort of services that would, I guess, facilitate that person coming out of that addiction. So I think if we think about decriminalization for what it is, as literally just saying that addiction is not a crime, I think our perspective on it would be a little bit more different.
Could we agree that drug use can lead to crime?
I think that drug use and crime do oftentimes go hand in hand, but I think that crime goes hand in hand with a lot of things nowadays, because crime is a means for people to get the things that they need. So, for example, I'm someone that's not particularly interested in the crime conversation without addressing issues like poverty, issues like capitalism that lead people to doing crime, right? So you can make the argument that that person is stealing because they want to get money for their drugs, but you could also make the argument that that person is stealing because they need food. So you can't say that addiction leads to crime. I would say that poverty leads to crime. I would say that things like not having a place to stay, a place to wash, a place to eat, a place to not having money for these things, you're going to need to get your needs met some way. And so if no one's giving you food, you're going to have to steal it. So once again, I'm not interested in the crime conversation.
Well, I am. I think that you're right, that poverty and other factors can lead to crime. But there's no question that drug use leads to crime. And it's a problem we have
How
to deal
so,
with.
How so, though?
Well, to get money to get more drugs, or just being high on meth causes people to do crazy things.
But it doesn't bother you that people need to get money to get food, and that crime is often the means that people without money get their food?
It does bother me, but I can have two conversations at once. I think it's okay to say that, when I was a prosecutor, people weren't committing crimes high on marijuana, but they were committing crimes high on cocaine, high on meth, and other drugs. I think these things can cause problems.
Yes, but I don't think that anyone that, I don't think that any random person that does meth or does cocaine or whatever hard drug you want to mention, I don't think that that person's guaranteed to commit a crime because they are high. I would say that there's probably something underlying within that person's pathology that might make them more likely to commit a crime while high, but I don't think that.
So when they go to the break, is he going to coming up here on KOW and then I hit the bed?
It should be okay for someone to sit across from an elementary school.
Awesome. Thank you.
And shoot up.
No, I don't think it should be okay for anyone to be in a public space and to shoot up, because I feel like there should be social safety nets put in place to help that person. We have a society where we see the person in the park shooting up and we think that they are some sort of moral failure, that they have bad morals, or that they are a bad person and that's why they're in the park shooting up, when really that person is probably in the park shooting up because they have nowhere else to go to shoot up, and it's cold and they probably want to be warm in some way. And we all know that heroin and alcohol and drugs warm you up. And it's also one of those things where if you're homeless and you're an addict, where are you going to do your drugs, right? So getting that person into treatment getting that person housing, these are ways that you can avoid having people in public parks, public parks shooting up.
This is a great conversation. I think Lauren did bring us back to the question of getting people into treatment, and even people who agree with a lot of what all of us are saying. I think one of the arguments for criminalization is that we could talk about whether this is true or not, but is that the threat of incarceration is the stick that some people need to stop using, because the idea that drug use is an illness, it's sort of a matter, it depends on how we're defining our terms, but it is this kind of illness, if we want to call it that, where the person keeps deciding, like, do we use that word? Is that, when you're addicted, can you decide anything? But the behavior, it's the continuation of the behavior is linked to the continued disease. Right, fair?
Yeah, and it also depends on what drug the person is on. So if we're talking about something like heroin, illness is probably the best way to put it, because if you're not constantly, feeding your body what it's used to, you will go into withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And people always talk about withdrawal being like one of the worst things that you can ever experience. So, it's a case-by-case basis in a lot of ways, but also not in a lot of ways. So I think it really does depend on that person. And I think that is also a problem. We don't have a approach that looks at the person. We kind of want this Band-Aid catch-all solution that we can apply to everyone doing drugs. And I don't think that's realistic.
I think that's right. It's just truly a individual challenge. At the same time, there's an interesting sort of systems question that Lauren teed up also, which is if you look at the synergies between the journey that Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco have done and gone through, there is this conversation of what does a robust safety net look like? What does that system look like? So the effort to sort of decriminalize on the legal side, the criminal side, and then to try to ask what does that social safety net look like relative to evidence-based global best practices like Copenhagen and Lisbon and other cities around the world? What are those learnings from around the world that are science-based or evidence-based that are going to give some confidence that there's some efficacy there? Those are legitimate questions. And yet the challenge is those three relatively wealthy cities that put lots of money into this really profoundly struggled with the increase. And I think a big association with is, as Lauren has suggested, is driven by fentanyl, the uniqueness of that unbelievably serious drug.
And cheap and accessible.
Yeah. All of those characteristics are so such a profound outlier from most previous experiences. So we are facing something unique. At the same time, those three cities, I don't think it's necessarily just a backlash in terms of the criminal issues. I think it's a backlash in terms of the community wanting to have conversations about what does a compassionate system look like that protects community connections as well. We don't want parks to be taken over by drug activity. We want it to be the benefit of the entire community, yet we don't want to throw people in prison every day of the week for small amounts of possession. So I think there's a deep struggle of what are those evidence-based global best practices that Seattle, Portland, San Francisco have learned, what's been successful, what hasn't. And I think we're really struggling to find that path.
Well, I have a question about that. I want to hear from Lauren, if you'll permit me, from Lauren and Saul. But since you're close to this as a former budget writer and legislator, I think I'm right that these West Coast cities in general have consistently failed in so many ways to set up the alternatives that they're talking about, whether it's alternatives to policing or whether it's behavioral health beds and treatment and substance use disorder treatment. I mean, we could get into job training, domestic violence. We're back to capitalism. We go on forever, right? But why do you think it is that these progressive governments consistently failed to plan for the changes they claimed they wanted to make?
I think it's a combination of factors. You know, there's a lot of money that's been thrown at this issue, and there's been a lot of struggle to figure out what those best practices really are. What do those systems that are healthy and robust and genuine in terms of supporting people in addiction, what do those look like? And then you've got this overlay with both the combination of fentanyl as well as behavioral health challenges. We have a pathetic behavioral health system, although we fund it. We've put huge amounts of money. The University of Washington has a new system. There's new buildings. There's new community beds. But it just is so disconnected from the need. So it's that complex nexus between addiction, behavioral health issues.
And affordable housing, which I forgot to mention.
It really is. And I know that that feels like an excuse, but there's a lot of money going into these systems. But I think all three of those cities, including ours, has really struggled to make the kind of progress that I think we need as at a systems level. It's a challenge.
We've got to take a break. Saul and Lauren, any last words before we do that? It's been a really good conversation. I appreciate this.
I'll just say that following up on what Ruvane said, these cities severely underestimated the problem. They were incompetent. That's the reason it failed. They failed to understand the severity of the problem and the need for treatment. And they had this idea that just by decriminalizing, we'll clear out the jails. And it didn't work.
Yeah, I think that decriminalization, like I said, isn't even a solution. It's literally just says that having an addiction isn't a crime. So when we want to talk about real solutions, I feel like we might actually get somewhere. But decriminalization is not a solution. It's just saying that being an addict isn't a crime, which I feel like is important.
Let me let a couple of listeners weigh in before we take a break. Pat in Greenwood says, Seattle became way too liberal. It's almost a religion here, and that makes me uncomfortable. I think it's healthy that we're bringing in some more conservative thinking. It's better for diversity of thought. Christine in Greenwood says, I don't think that particular brand of progressivism, defund the police, decriminalization of drugs, etc., has been around all that long. So it's not like there's now a radical policy shift from longstanding policies. I just think it means we've seen the downsides of some of the more progressive policies and are ready to go back to a more centrist approach. And Oslin says, while I agree to some mixed policies to balance out, I'm concerned about the lean towards more conservatism. Conservatism has never been fair to the middle class or lower social levels, nor has it been fair to POC or immigrants, legal or otherwise. So thank you for all that mix of opinions. We're on KOW's Week in Review, taking a quick break and coming right back with more news of this week. Stay tuned.
Support comes from Pacific Science Center, working to inspire the next generation of scientists and increase access to STEM education statewide through digital discovery workshops, science on wheels, and summer camps. More ways to support these efforts at pacsci.org. Support comes from the Discovery Inn on Washington's San Juan Island, an island getaway that's a ferry ride away, now taking reservations for summer and fall. More information and booking available at discoveryinn.com.
KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with former Washington Democratic legislator Reuven Carlisle. We have Saul Gammarin here, former chair of Nikki Haley's Washington campaign, and South Seattle Emeralds, Lauren Bray. And we're telling you what happened this week, a little bit about what it means. We've been following this odyssey of asylum seekers here. Hundreds of people from South America, Africa, came to a Methodist church in Tukwila, which is filled up. The migrants have stayed in hotels and private rentals across the county. Protesters called on Seattle to help them more. Seattle said, it's not really our problem. We don't have the money. We've already mentioned $240 million deficit. Some of the migrants came to the city this week, and it just goes on. There was an anonymous donor helped these migrants leave Seattle again for a hotel in Kent, but for about a week and a half. So any thoughts about where we stand?
Well, I feel like we just need a better solution to it. And I think it is going to be a federal solution. I think we need to completely rethink our immigration system. It hasn't had an update in 3 decades. And where we are in the international climate, a lot of people are experiencing different things in their home countries. There's political persecution people are fleeing from. People are fleeing from, you know, poverty, crime in their neighborhoods, in their home countries. So there's a lot of desperation, a lot of struggle that people are trying to escape from. And I always talk about immigration from the perspective of an American. And so me being someone that's from America, born here, I've seen the discord that we've sowed in other nations. You know, U.S. imperialism is pervasive throughout the world. And when people are on the lower end of, like, the economic spectrum in their home country, they look at America and they're like, it's the land of opportunity. And people want to come here and they want to work and they want a better life for their families. They want a slice of a pie that we all have, right? So I think that we owe it to people. We owe it to, you know, our future citizens to provide for them and to give them the space to be able to create that life that they want.
Why can't we, this is, the cities have spent money on this issue. Just talking about these groups of asylum seekers in King County, county government, state government, Lauren mentioned the federal government. They keep getting bounced around. Why, you know, money has been allocated that's going to come some other time that's not yet. Why can't we do better than this?
It's a super legitimate question. I mean, I think we need to say straight up that it's fundamentally the state's obligation. We know that federal government is in charge of immigration relative to the borders. But in terms of receiving folks, in terms of figuring out how to get them out of tents, there needs to be a coordinated approach. There's no question that the state has a responsibility to do that. You know, it's interesting. King County Council Member Jorge Barone said something very interesting, and he said that what's different about this particular group of individuals is that they don't have an immediate connection to the area. They don't have relatives. Yep. A lot of these asylum seekers.
They came through SeaTac Airport. Yep. To
Correct.
Tukwila.
And that's a profound difference. And that, yes. You know, the Ukrainian community, so many other communities have been integrated in because they have connections. There's not any immediate connection to King County.
Hey, Kevin.
Or Tukwila. So to play a coordinating role.
When Burns run on the board, does he typically out of commercial underwriting spots, does he say now back to Week in Review, or does he just go straight to Bill?
With the nonprofits and local governments. I don't think.
Sounds good.
Like,
perfect.
Individual city to solve this while we're doing exactly what Lauren said, which is at the national level, at least have a policy in place the way I think President Biden very much has tried to do. And you've seen that blocked.
Well, I'd respectfully disagree with you about the current administration. You know, I mean, one of the core strengths of American exceptionalism is immigration. We're a melting pot, unlike Europe, which doesn't integrate people very well. But it needs to be done legally. And this administration has made the southern border so porous that we're seeing the results of it. And Congress is, of course, unable to even talk to each other, so they're not getting anything done. Both parties are responsible, but here we are, and these people are here, and so
and they're legally seeking asylum, aren't they, and waiting for work permits. This is not a case
yeah.
of
yeah, and
is
it's,
that right?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where a lot of people are completely unable to work, and there's the difference with the Ukrainian community, as you mentioned. Ukrainian migrants are able to come to the country and work almost immediately. Meanwhile, migrants from Africa and South America, they have to go through this arduous process of applying through the legal system for work permits, seeking asylum. And so I always wonder, why do we show favoritism based off of the country that people are coming from? Why are members of the Ukrainian community able to come and work very easily, whereas migrants that come from countries in Africa and South America, they have to go through this long, long legal process?
Anybody know? I'm no expert. Okay, but maybe I interrupted you, so I want to make sure I want to let you finish your thought.
No, I'm fine. Okay. I think, though, in response to what Lauren said, I think that there's probably prejudices involved why we allow Ukrainians in and not people from other countries. But remember, the Ukrainian community here is taking them in and integrating them. So there's certain advantages, but I'm suspicious as to why we make it harder for people from other countries.
Yeah. Okay, in other news this week, before we take another break and start, because we're already two-thirds of the way into the show, you know, Seattle is, what's Seattle best known for, would you say?
Coffee.
Coffee.
Nowadays, tech.
Yeah, true. Space Needle jumped to mind, but I'm old. Pike Place Market, certainly, is where a lot of folks end up. Have you, any of you ever accidentally turned down, as you're driving, turned along Pike Place? And found that you're stuck and may die there?
Well, Bill, you know my answer.
Yeah, I know your answer. Lauren doesn't drive. I envy you. I admire you for that.
She's but a true New Yorker.
Yes. Very nice. It's a mess. Pike Place is confusing to tourists who end up trying to drive along that cobblestone or brick street. It's arguably dangerous. Some people want to completely close Pike Place to cars or even make it a so-called event street, which means occasionally it could be closed to cars. The organization that runs the market, Pike Place Public Development Authority, has pushed back and they said, quote, it's not an event street. It's not a cafe street. It's a market street. It has been since the market was founded in that street in 1907. Before you disagree, I want to pass on. I found an op-ed written in the Seattle Times recently by supporters of allowing car traffic to continue just the way it is. And this is someone from Friends of the Market and Peter Steinbrook, you know, former city councilor. And they said, quote, the zesty, bustling jumble of vendors, pedestrians, slow-moving cars, and delivery vehicles is what makes the market unique and genuine. Pedestrians have the same right to be on Pike Place as the truck delivery vehicle, the rideshare drop-off, the restaurateurs picking up supplies, and the van dropping off Americans with Disabilities Act or elderly passengers. In fact, pedestrians dominate the street during the busiest times of the year, and there's a sense of safety in numbers over cars. And I am a big transit walking fan, but I got to say that description sounded right to me. So go from there. You disagree?
I think there's a certain romance to that concept. I just think that, look, it's just impossible to go to a place like Lisbon or Paris or the great cities of the world and not be extraordinarily impacted by the sense of community, the sense of authenticity that comes with the hustle and bustle of a car-free environment. You know, it's a couple of blocks. We know that Pike Place Market is part of the soul and DNA of this city and the region. Millions of people visit it. There's all kinds of economic. That hub and bubble is great. It just feels like there ought to be a win-win. Why can't we have a couple of hours in the morning for all the deliveries, recognizing that it's a working farmer's market? That's an important part of it. We want people with disabilities to have access without question. At the same time, there is something special. Maybe we try it out for a summer. Maybe we just mix and match it a little bit more. And just holding on to the idea that cars are absolutely central to that deeper sense of community is a struggle for me. I think it's two blocks. You got 99.9% of the city for cars. To have their own way. And it's just two blocks that it feels like we ought to be able to find a pathway where it's more pedestrian oriented.
Well, Reuven, I've agreed with you so much. I guess it's finally time for me to disagree with you about something.
It's time.
I'm sensitive to the vendors, and the vendors don't want this. So I'd want to explore and understand more why they don't. Now, maybe you're right. Maybe it's about having certain hours during the day, or maybe it's weekends, or maybe it's trying it for 2 months. But I'd want to work with the vendors and make sure they're comfortable with whatever we do.
I agree. I think that if the vendors are saying that they have some sort of reason to want the cars there, we could definitely hear it out. But I'm definitely going to agree with Reuven. I feel like we can spare two blocks in the city for pedestrian-only traffic. I think that, I can't even imagine why cars would need to be there other than, unloading or
masochism?
Loading. I don't know. Loading and unloading disabled folks, that's the only reason why I could imagine it being absolutely necessary. I think that Reuven's idea of having hours in the morning where we're loading and unloading for vendors, I think that is a really good suggestion. But yeah, I don't understand why we can't spare the two blocks.
Let me ask you this. I've never heard of a situation in the paper or news where anyone's been injured by a car in the Park Place Market. Now, maybe it's happened. I'm just not aware of it. My question is, what's the harm in the cars? How are they harming the market?
I've had to dodge a few cars.
Well, we dodge them all the time. I mean, it's like a Frogger game. But my question is, what's the downside of the cars?
Lisbon, Paris.
Exactly.
You heard Reuven Carlisle.
Exactly. I got $50 million in the state budget to try to redo and reimagine Aurora 99, a couple of blocks. Imagine for just a second what could be possible with a new approach. And I think the hardcore urbanists on this one, there's just something to their spark of energy about this idea that we can imagine some of these neighborhoods and areas with some areas blocked off. And, you know, maybe the top of Queen Anne, maybe it's just one day a week, or maybe it's in a different neighborhood, all the different neighborhoods. I just don't think it has to be so extremely driven by the automobile. And, you know, I love cars. It's one of my weaknesses. I have a 1967 Mustang convertible as a toy. I acknowledge that. But I also feel like we can do better, and it helps with quality of life to slow everything down. It helps with quality of life in terms of climate and emissions and walkability and neighborhood stores. And I just believe in that vision. I think it's possible without going to war to say that every car has to be shut down Thursday.
Maybe tourists and Americans in general, even Seattleites, maybe love their cars so much that the market doesn't want people to think of the market as a no-go, as someplace I can only go if I'm strolling. I could theoretically drive through it, you know, and look around and see stuff, and then turn and go to the parking garage and park there. You know, maybe it's psychological. I don't know.
We also have a big investment coming, close to $1 billion in the Seattle waterfront.
Right.
And I think we're entering this new era where let's hope that the design really unleashes the potential of that pedestrian connection, the direct connection between higher up and the waterfront itself, reconnecting the life of the city to the waterfront that was just part of our soul for a long time that was lost with the viaduct. So we're entering this era, and this is a time to reimagine our designs and to integrate it in a much way and just slow the heck down.
Yeah, maybe the waterfront will help with a tipping point.
Correct.
Just think of it as walking, if assuming you're able to walk around as much as you want, more than cars. Okay, we got to take a break and then come right back and then wrap the show up, hit a couple of headlines and give you something to smile about when we return on Week in Review. Can I quote you, Saul?
Yes.
We're back on the air.
Sure.
What did you just say? If I'm in an echo chamber,
I'm not going to learn anything. I learn by talking to people with different perspectives, and that's what I appreciate.
The new host of Week in Review, there's Saul Gamaran. I'll be retiring now. Well said. Saul Gamaran of Gamaran Legal Consulting, who ran Nikki Haley's Washington State campaign.
Yep.
South Seattle.
Yep, 52. I'll do that.
Former state legislator Reuven Carlisle. And we're just about ready to wrap this show up. I'll just mention a few things briefly that happened this week. Linwood, Shoreline, Mount Lake Terrace, what do they all have in common? They're going to get light rail too by August 30th is the plan, just before Labor Day weekend. That Sound Transit news came down this week. Also, Seattleites are going to vote on a new and bigger property tax levy for transportation projects, streets, bridges, sidewalks, traffic signals, bike lanes. The old Move Seattle levy was for 9 years and $930 million. That was the biggest ask yet at the time. It cost homeowners $24 a month on an average home. The new proposed levy that Seattle will vote on is $1.35 billion for 8 years, costing that homeowner $36 a month instead of $24. The city council announced that they want support workers to work in the office at least 4 days a week. And that workers who want to get an exception have until June 24th to work that out with their boss. That was a lot. Did anybody, by the way, have any reaction to any of those stories?
Sound Transit.
Yeah.
You know, I think we have seen so many years of so much pain. We haven't seen one good headline in goodness knows how long. the idea that they're getting ready to access Snohomish County and provide that service extended is just a wonderful thing. Imagine a future where we really have a deeply integrated transportation system. We've paid for it. We're paying for it. Let's get it. And I just think it's going to be amazing for the people in that whole area to have access to all the way to the airport and beyond.
That was a little preview of our What Made You Smile This Week segment.
It is.
Excellent. A couple more things before we get there. Mount Rainier National Park just started taking reservations to visit Paradise and Sunrise in July. They're doing this timed entry now because the trails are so congested. And starting May 1, you can reserve for the months of August and September. You can still go to the park before 7 a.m., after 3 p.m. without a reservation, but during those peak times. Reservation plus entrance fee, please, or your park pass. Okay, let's get right to the smile stuff. What? Anything else? So Sound Transit coming to North King County, and is Snohomish too? No, Shoreline, Mount Lake Terrace,
Linwood.
Yeah, Linwood, right. Linwood. Thank you. Made Reuven smile. Anybody else?
Biden called for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Did he? How, like real officially, or wouldn't it be nice?
Well, the word on the street is that following the death of the 7 aid workers,
yep,
that Biden has called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Or else?
Well, I'm not sure what the or else is. Mm-hmm. But I guess the word on the street is that Israelis fear Biden's intolerable ceasefire demands. We will see what the demands are, and we will see what happens.
All right. Saul, anything make the corners of your mouth go up?
Yes, I went to a fantastic Italian restaurant in West Seattle this week called Il Nido with my wife and some friends. It took me about a month to get in there. It was delicious, and it made me smile the whole meal.
Wow. West Seattle is back. Was it thriving and
yes,
bustling
it is.
And happy around there?
Yes, it is.
West Seattle.
You're from West Seattle?
No, I love it there.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't love West Seattle? I was there last week. I adore West Seattle. I got something to – I'm not – well, first of all, I'm not smiling about this, but I know somebody is. Two Seattle radio stations went country this week. Alt station KPNW, which dropped country a year or so ago, is now 98.9 The Bull. And sadly for me, one of my kids' favorites, Star 101.5, now calling itself Hank FM. But if either Hank or The Bull plays the live version of Willie Nelson's Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground from the Honeysuckle Rose soundtrack, that's a country song that will make me smile. So I included it. We got, you know, every year we wait for when is the Seattle Times going to run its annual headline that says it's too early to panic about the Mariners. And it happened to cut, like, the cherry blossoms and the Mariners too soon to panic headline are rites of spring. It was a couple days early, April 3rd. This week we got that headline, too early to panic about Mariners' slow start. And then this, drivers in parts of King County will see new flashing road signs telling you to buckle up or put down your phone.
We have spent 4 years developing a special infrared sensor that can detect the difference of wavelengths to be able to see that there's a phone in someone's hand. And it could be able to detect if it's a driver or passenger, and we can also detect if they're using a cradle or things of that nature. Organic and inorganic material use different frequencies. And so by identifying the unique signature of the difference of frequency between a phone in the hand, you can identify whether there's a phone in their hand or whether someone's not wearing a seatbelt.
That is flashing sign maker Tim Hogan of Safer Street Solutions, who says if the infrared says you're holding your phone, the sign will flash phone down, phone down.
One of the things that we've done is we've done sensor and then a sign and then a sensor. So we can really kind of measure how many people are changing their behavior in that moment. And so typically we see 40-50% of people putting down their phone instantly. We can literally go sit by the sign and watch people put their phone down. And I mean, it's one of my biggest excitements to see that immediate behavior change.
Same with the seatbelt. The infrared says you don't have your seatbelt on. As they say, buckle up, buckle up. And I asked Tim, can you see through tinted windows at people cheating in the carpool lane? And he says they don't have that application yet.
I don't know. I have to tell you, that's one view of it. Another view of it is not crazy about the government having biometric data. I worked pretty hard on privacy legislation with my good friend Senator Joe Wynn on biometric data, the government owning that data. And, you know, I think there's a really important boundary there.
Well, tell me, Reuven Carlisle here, I asked Tim Hogan about this. He said the signs will not collect data that would identify you. But is that the problem? Is that mollify you?
Yeah, of course. Aggregating data and with anonymous filters is an important part of it. At the same time, it's not hard to disaggregate. There are issues with it. And I just think it's a question when the government has that data, it's one thing. Now, obviously, you go to TSA and they're moving to biometric data. There are applications that are being used. I'm just not sure that that this one is the most important obligation of government.
Wait, there's a sign flashing. Put your objection down. Reuven, put your objection down. Anything else before we go?
I just think Reuven's right. I mean, who supports Big Brother?
Now you're back to agreeing. Who likes Big Brother? Nobody. Not on this panel.
Not on this panel.
Not Sal Gamaran, founder and president of Gamaran Legal Consulting, former Nikki Haley chair, maybe future Nikki Haley chair if the Republicans bail on Trump. Doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
Let's hope.
Okay. Founder of Earth Finance and former member of the Washington State House and Senate, Reuven Carlisle. Thank you, Reuven. From the South Seattle Emerald, reporter and writer, Lauren Bray. Lauren, thanks for coming on the show again this week.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you to producer Kevin Kniestet. Thank you to Kevin Deers, running the board, and Juan Pablo Chiquiza and Tio Popescu helping you watch the show. I'm Bill Radke, and I look forward to seeing you again a week from now. Come on back.